going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
Maryland, our time is right now. Our time is now to build a state that for those who came before us, that they fought for, and it's a state that leaves no one behind. This is not a slogan. It is the fulfillment of a hope. Maryland, it's time. Let's lead, and let's do it together.
He began with a rousing speech with soaring themes of a new direction for Maryland. 44-year-old Wesley Watende Omari Moore, sworn in today as the 63rd governor of Maryland, the first African-American to hold the office. Tonight, we talk about the historic significance of the day and the work ahead. We'll also talk about D.C.'s criminal code, why some of the revisions are considered controversial. We'll also discuss President Biden's classified documents problems. My guests are Dr. Marcus Board, political science professor here at Howard University, and Jaron Keith Gaynor, White House correspondent and managing editor of politics for The Griot. We also want to hear from you today. What are your thoughts about some of the topics of the week, including this historic moment in Maryland politics? Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H. Fisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Board, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Jaron, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let us first talk about today. This was an historic day in Maryland. We are seeing one of the most diverse concentrations of leadership in the state, literally as of today. Governor Moore, the first black man to hold the governor's office in Maryland, Aruna Miller, the first Indian immigrant to hold the position of lieutenant governor. We have Anthony Brown, who is the attorney general. So we've got a lot going on here, but let's talk about the history first, Dr. Board. Your thoughts about it?
Yeah, it's always a big news when any black person wins the governor. A lot of times, you know, for most of our lives, I'd say, we talked about the first black president. We wanted a black person to be president, and not fully realizing that we don't have a lot of black governors ever. And so in and of itself, in its own right, it does deserve to be acknowledged and recognized that having a black governor anywhere in these United States is a big deal. Winning over that majority in any state is very hard. It's challenging. And the reality is in the way that race works in the United States, you're always going to have trouble winning over a majority of people because black people aren't the majority. So our willingness to vote for a black candidate does not guarantee they're going to get our votes, but you still have to be able to win a large racial coalition, and Wes Moore was able to do that.
Indeed, and not to mention that he was able to cross not only the racial lines, but also the political lines. This was a landslide for him to win the governor's seat. You know, but Jaron, you know, one of the things, and there were many things that struck me today, was the symbolism of how the day started when he, his wife, and his children, surrounded by, you know, other high-profile black politicians and others, had a ceremony at the Annapolis dock where enslaved black people in Maryland first came to this country, and then that symbolic walk to the governor, to the state house. Your thoughts about the imagery there?
Yeah, I think it was very powerful, and I think it was so important, not just for Marylanders to see that symbolism, but for Americans. In so many ways, Wes Moore you know, represents the future of what America can be. And that's especially important given the political climate that we find ourselves in today, where when we think about Democrats and Republicans, it's extremely polarizing. And to your point, you know, Maryland has such a deep, rich history as it relates to the settlement of Black enslaved people and immigrants before and after the Civil War. And Maryland had the largest Black population of any southern city in 1870 when the 15th Amendment was ratified. And so it was a day of celebration, but also a day to reflect on the past of Maryland and the country. But like, as I said, also focusing so much on the future. And so it was very powerful to see not just Westmore standing there as a Black man, but also what he represents. You know, he represents he's a veteran, so he represents the United States Air Force, the Army, and he represents Baltimore, representing Black people of Baltimore who often get lost in the political conversation when we talk about Maryland. So so many people were left inspired and emotional. And I think it was also powerful to see that Westmore, when he gave his oath of office, he had his hand on the Bible of Frederick Douglass, you know, someone who was born in Maryland and was so instrumental in the Black suffragist movement. And also underneath that Bible was the Bible that belonged to his grandfather, who was a minister and an immigrant himself. And so Westmore represents so many communities, and I think so many people felt seen in this ceremony today.
And I think, again, when you talk about the whole diversity of the day, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, for example, Aruna Miller, who, when she was sworn in, her hand was on the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu text. We've never seen that. And I think it speaks to not only the, you know, the ethnic diversity of this moment, but also the religious diversity of the moment. And let us also say, politically, Westmore has never held an elected office before. Aruna Miller is no political slouch. She started in the Democratic Central Committee in Montgomery County. Then she became a delegate. And so one could assume that she's going to help him kind of navigate the difficulties of the politics here.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And just to point out, like you said, about religious diversity and the significance of that, it's also to say that in spite of Aruna Miller's extraordinary experiences as a woman, it's still very hard to get into that governor's seat.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think as a first-time elected officer, Westmore is going to have a very tall hill to climb. I think that the first set of battles, he can feign ignorance and say, well, you know, I'm new to this and I'm figuring it out. But I do think that one of the reasons why people in the U.S. and Maryland in particular are pushing for people who haven't had the same type of Washington experience, they see the division, they see the, you know, Democrats versus Republicans and all kinds of madness going on, and they're trying to find somebody who can change the conversation. Now, whether or not Westmore can be that person is yet to be determined. There's been a lot of questions about what his policy prescriptions are actually going to be. But I think one of the things that he has shown, particularly as we said about tapping into the history with Frederick Douglass, getting up there with Oprah, taking the walk, you know, talking the talk, and talking big talk, really. The hope is that he will, at the very least, be able to make some of the common sense changes that every state, frankly, needs. And I think Maryland historically is in a position to be the state that a Black person becomes the governor, the third governor of the United States, third Black governor, excuse me. And so it also speaks to the long history that you need to even be able to get here. So in many ways, and we were talking about this before, you and I and Candace and I, in many ways, I did expect him to win, particularly when he won the Democratic nomination, obviously. But it's also because of that historical and political relationship that we've seen elected officials since Obama in particular be able to tap into very successfully, to be able to say, I am, you know, my ancestors' wildest dreams. And for those who want to vote for me, those dreams go into elected office.
I must admit, I did not initially think that he would win. I was thinking that Peter Franchot may have been the obvious choice. So that means do not call me to pick your Powerball numbers. But, you know, that's not my ministry. But I think that as an observer, you know, 24 hours a week in politics, a month in politics is a really, really long time. And he, as they say, showed up and showed out and really, really wowed Maryland voters. Let me go to the phone lines. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at the political roundtable. Right now we're talking about the historic inauguration of Wes Moore as the first black governor of Maryland. Let's talk to John calling from Lanham. Hey, John, what's on your mind? Thanks for calling.
Hey, Harold, thanks for having me. So kind of like a two-part kind of, you know, statement here. So obviously everything is built on hope right now. Wes Moore is a, you know, a person that's supposed to bring change. Now, given that he's another black figure put into a, you know, higher office, what is the likelihood that we could actually make changes? Me being a younger individual, we need a little bit more. Like, we need to see this change, and actually it will help us, you know, come out to these polls a little more, seeing that he's actually able to do something.
Jaron, I'll let you share your thoughts about that, but I think that's a really interesting question.
Yeah, I think that is the question of the moment, right? We don't know whether or not Wes Moore will be able to really deliver. I think it is notable that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, he is, you know, a son of Baltimore, and he's deeply, you know, connected to the community, and says that he wants to enact changes. Shameless plug: The Griot's April Ryan had a sit down interview with Wes Moore. And he talked about wanting to address the racial wealth gap in Maryland, but specifically in Baltimore. The one in eight black families are in poverty, as he notes. He talked about wanting to advocate for the youth and address the crime issues, but also making sure that police officers are held accountable. And so oftentimes we see politicians say they want to do these things. And as my colleague mentioned, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not Wes Moore will be able to deliver and what those policy prescriptions will actually be. But if he is able to make some headway in Maryland and really, really bring change, it obviously sets him up for what many people hope he could be for the Democratic Party. Barack Obama's name was mentioned. He's often been compared to the former president. And he is, you know, he's a father, he's a husband, and people kind of see that parallel. He's an orator, Rhodes Scholar. So obviously he sounds the part, but can he fit the role? Can he arise to the occasion? I think everyone is waiting to see what happens.
Yeah. John, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tony, calling from Fort Washington. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. Hi, this is Connie Moore.
Connie, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm very excited to have a black governor for the state of Maryland. I've been a resident of Maryland for over 10 years, and it's about time. And I think that Wes Moore is going to do a fantastic job. And I'm just very excited that, again, he was nominated and elected and won the governorship for the state of Maryland. And I'm looking forward to him doing great things for.
Connie, I think we lost you, but thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I think we can't not mention the Oprah factor. The last time Oprah Winfrey endorsed a politician, he became president.
I think I heard of that.
Right, exactly. So, and so now she has endorsed a candidate, now governor, black governor. Oprah, it seems to be setting herself up as kingmaker. The Oprah effect cannot be ignored.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and to the last two comments, too, the excitement is real. I think we can't underscore the fact that there was a movement for black lives happening over the last few years and decade that has landed in Maryland, and of course Baltimore in particular with the uprising had a significant experience with that. What that's done for the state of Maryland is a racial reckoning and in electoral politics, because you have, you know, you have sound bites, you know, as we were just hearing a lot of the points that he made, you know, the 1 in 8 child poverty, these lines that he's delivering, and even John, our caller, said, I want a little more. I was like, oh, was that one of the slogans? But I think one of the things we have to remember is that Maryland wants to show themselves to be this liberal progressive state, right? And that's where my confidence came in this race, that there's this guy, he has this military background, he's a Rhodes Scholar, he got Oprah, he got books, right? Yeah. He's in there. I know he's from Pasadena, but he has ties and connections to Baltimore.
And Montgomery County, mm-hmm. He has the political pedigree. The optics are right, but now the work begins. Mm-hmm. I need to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Denise, calling from Upper Marlboro. She's going to tell us why she voted. Also, we are going to touch on the issue regarding the D.C. criminal code revision, the first in 100 years, and why the mayor is unhappy with it. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. Still taking your calls at 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment.
It's impossible not to think about our past and our path. We're blocks away from the Annapolis docks, where so many enslaved people arrived in this country against their will, and we are standing in front of a Capitol that was built by their hands. Today is not an indictment of the past. Today is a celebration of our collective future.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are at the political roundtable on deck today, the historic inauguration of the 63rd governor of the state of Maryland, the first African-American to hold that office in Maryland's history, Wes Moore. We're also going to be talking about the D.C. criminal code revision, and we're going to touch on President Biden's document problems. Can we say docugate? There's a gate on the end of everything. Of course, my guests are Dr. Marcus Board, political science professor here at Howard University, and Jaron Keith Gaynor, White House correspondent and managing editor of Politics for The Griot. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Denise, calling from Upper Marlboro. Thanks for calling, Denise. What's on your mind?
So thank you for taking my call. So
sure.
Yes, my name is Denise, and I've actually, I'm very proud that I voted for Wes Moore for governor. I'm very proud to have a black governor. I've been working as a licensed realtor in the state of Maryland for 30 years. But I also voted for Larry Hogan when he was governor. I voted for him twice because I thought that he would do a good job, and he did do a good job. I think I have all the confidence that Wes Moore will do a good job. But Marylanders vote for the best person for the job, not based on a political party, because I'm a registered Democrat. But I voted for Hogan twice. But Marylanders vote for the best person for the job, and I'm proud of that, too.
All right, Denise, thank you so much for your comment. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Denise makes a really interesting point because that last poll right before Larry Hogan left office said that he had an 80% approval rating among registered Democrats in the state. You can't buy those kind of numbers as a Republican in 2023.
No. So this is the thing, and this is why Wes Moore was positioned so well to win this election. And this is not to undermine at all what Denise is saying, but to say that he straddles the line in the way that the Democrats and Republicans very often do these days. Now, we do, of course, have in the national elections and on the national stage extremists. You have the Trumps. You have... what's the turtle man name? Mitch McConnell, excuse me. You got Mitch, right? You got people who are on these extremes, these polar extremes. And then you have, you know, the squad on the other side, right? But when it comes to winning an election in a state like Maryland, you have to be in the center.
Yeah.
And Wes Moore is in the center. And to the extent that he's not in the center, we don't know because he doesn't have the political history. This also is following... he's in a post-Obama world. We've seen this play. We've seen it happen before. So there's that part. But I also want to make sure that we understand that governors have extreme power. Part of the reason why it's so hard to get a black governor is because they have so much power. And so we really need to keep in mind that the political gridlock that we see at the national level is not nearly a problem at the state level.
Not right now, although, you know, Jaron, the Democrats in Maryland are not without their history of infighting. Certainly, at least maybe for the first year or so, you know, Governor Moore may have a bit of a honeymoon. Because again, if you look at the diversity of the leadership, and I spoke about this, you know, earlier, but first of all, Democrats outnumber Republicans in the House of Delegates and the state Senate by 2-1. You've got Brooke Learman, who is the first woman to be the comptroller. She's a white woman. You've got the Maryland Senate President, Bill Ferguson. He's a Democrat. He's a white guy. But then you've got, again, the Speaker of the House, Adrienne Jones, who is a black woman from Baltimore, the first black woman to hold that position. And, of course, as I mentioned before, you have Anthony Brown, who, again, another Democrat, who is the attorney general. And so you've got this leadership. Jaron, I would imagine the Democrats have an opportunity here to show up and show out, but they can't mess up.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really important because in some ways what happens on the state level could have ramifications on the national stage and how people perceive Democrats. And I think it's interesting, as my colleague mentioned about Wes Moore being at the center, I am curious to see, you know, where he lands as a politician. I suspect that, you know, you mentioned a honeymoon. I think that honeymoon will last for quite some time. I mean, Wes Moore will likely be a love fest, not just in the media, but in the political circles of just people wanting to be close to Wes Moore. And so I'm interested to see whether or not that will kind of cloud how effective he will be as a politician. I think that if he surrounds himself with the right people, and obviously the Democrats who have in Maryland who have more experience on legislating, I'm sure that he will have that guidance. But it will be certainly an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah. Let me go to Yvonne calling from Bowie. Yvonne, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mr. Fisher. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Yvonne. Good to hear from you. What's going on?
Likewise. I just don't feel good about it. I really don't, and I did not vote for Wes Moore because I don't think that he's the man for the job. I really don't. And I only believe that he got the vote because he is African American.
Okay, so
but I just don't think he's going to do a good job. I really don't. No experience, and he's a fast talker. And I think he just, I don't believe he's a truthful person. Hmm. I really don't. I don't think he can be trusted. I don't trust him.
So let me offer this to you, not in defense of Wes Moore, but let's look at the facts that you just laid out regarding his experience. The man who came before him, Larry Hogan, was a businessman from Harford County, Maryland. He had no political experience. He decided that he saw some things that he didn't like, and he had a vision. He ran. He was elected, and he helped to pilot the state through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. There are certainly. No politician is perfect, but but you're talking about a Republican in a blue state. He made it purple, and one of the things that I think a lot of Democrats liked about Larry Hogan is that he was very, very purposeful in his pushback of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And I voted for Mr. Hogan.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah. And you're not alone. No. You're not alone when it comes to black voters.
Not at all. Okay. Not at all.
Yeah.
Okay. I think, beyond the your comfort in voting for Wes Moore or lack thereof and your questions about his character and his intentions and his capacity to do the job, I can't, of course, speak to that. Right. That's his campaign's job, is to convince you that he can do the job. But I can say that one of the things at the state and local level, again, that really changes the conversation versus what we talk about on the national level is uh-huh. that at the state and local level, people are a lot more center than even they realize sometimes. And so when you get into the research and the data and all that stuff about social sciences and political science and in the U.S., what you find is that generally people want to use police to solve crimes. They want to use the courts to keep their neighborhoods safe. They want to have nice things and not necessarily pay all the money to have it, right? There's significant, overwhelming agreement across race, across gender, across age, even in the United mm-hmm. States when you narrow down to the state level. And so when you get to the question of partisanship, I do think Wes Moore and Larry Hogan are very similar.
Yeah,
extraordinarily similar.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think so.
I know you don't. I know. But what I think is that there is a complicated factor here that we don't really get to talk about, which is, again, the movement. So okay. when we're talking about these two-party systems, and there's a whole French words involved to talk about why it always ends up being two parties that we're not going to talk about. Harold Williams, he turned all the way away. But the point is that what ends up happening is that in a pluralist society, it's going to come down to two things, right? It's going to come down to Nike and Reebok. It's going to come down to Apple and Google, right? It's going to come down to these big two. And at the end of the day, they're going to be real similar. You might have an iPhone. You might have an Android. But the reality is you got a smartphone. You're going to do your email. You're going to send your texts. You're going to surf the internet. And then you're going to get off the phone, yeah. right? It's going to do the same type of stuff. And we're going to see that here. Now, the question becomes, at what point is this state capable of electing somebody who can actually push the boundaries? And this is not that election. And that's fine, but we should call it what it is.
Yeah. Yvonne, thank you so much for your phone call. Let's switch gears a little bit here, because I want to get into the criminal code. The D.C. Council, by a vote of 12-1, overrode Mayor Muriel Bowser's veto of the criminal code. Now, you've got to remember, this criminal code had not been revised in a century, 100 years. And this process took 16 years. Now, certainly there are a whole lot of things about the criminal code that needed to be and were, thrown out. Obviously, there were some things that were probably racist and sexist that just did not apply, things related to jaywalking and all of these other kinds of things that were easy to address. But the big issue had to do with guns. And gun violence on our street. I want to read to you just a little bit of the letter that Mayor Bowser sent to Chairman Phil Mendelson on the 4th of January when this issue was coming up. This was just ahead of the vote. And, you know, one of the things that she says is that the revised code reduces sentences for illegally carrying a gun on our streets. In particular, felons in possession of a gun pose a danger to our communities. The U.S. Sentencing Commission has found firearms offenders recidivate at a higher rate and more quickly following the release into the community. And she continues, she says, the council reduced the maximum penalty from 15 years down to just 4 years and rejected Councilmember Brooke Pinto's amendment that would have addressed some of these concerns. And it goes on and on and on. The mayor has gone on record, Jaron, saying that she is not opposed to the lion's share of these revisions, but the gun issue has raised her hackles. We saw an issue last night, again, a 15-year-old accused of killing an innocent bystander, a 54-year-old woman on Benning Road who was just walking to a carryout to get some food. And this is what the mayor is talking about, Jaron.
Yeah, I mean, the gun violence is not just an issue in D.C., but all across the country. And it's something that, you know, when I'm in the White House press briefing room, it often comes up on the national level. And, you know, even in Congress, we can't seem to find a consensus on gun reform. And so it doesn't surprise me that we see this issue on the state level, because even our leadership on the federal level has yet to find that consensus. We have more guns in this country than we have people. And we all can agree that that's problematic.
I'm interested in hearing what you're hearing in the White House briefing room from whom, your journalistic colleagues. Are you hearing it from the administration? Tell us a little more about that.
We know that, you know, after we had that tragic shooting earlier last year in the school, you know, it really galvanized lawmakers on the Hill to actually do something. And the bill that they ended up passing into law didn't go far enough, as President Biden has often said. And there has been continuously been mass shootings across this country. And he has repeatedly, whenever he's asked this question, or whenever White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre is asked about the issue of gun violence, they always kind of pivot and say, you know, we need our Republican lawmakers on the Hill to work with Democrats to go further, to ban assault weapons, and to, you know, really tighten our laws to address gun violence. The problem is that, you know, when we have this two-party system where one party wants to go out one direction, the other party wants to go in the other, we have this quagmire. And so oftentimes the White House is pivoting because they know that ultimately they can't do it alone. And so, you know, I often encourage people to remember that it's the voters, you know, who have the say, but we have to, you know, who we elect into office really matters. And I think that when it comes to gun violence, that people really care about their community and really want to see this issue be resolved, we have to exercise our civic duty and ensure that we are electing the right people into office, because this is an issue that's been going on for decades. This is something that it's a can that gets kicked down the road year after year, And so I guess the question is always, like, when is enough enough? And I know that personally, you know, as a journalist and covering these tragic stories, you know, it's challenging. It's challenging to see, especially when it feels like there's something, when you know something can be done, but lawmakers just won't move the needle.
Your thoughts about the revisions for the most serious crimes addressed in the criminal code, Dr. Board?
Yeah, I think it is. It's humorous, but it's not funny that the mayor is citing data about recidivism and not actually tapping into the fact that punishment has never successfully convinced people to stop committing crimes anywhere. So her focus, her emphasis on recidivism rates for people committing violent crimes shows it's a political play, and it's unfortunate to see her doing that. But as far as the bill is concerned, to your point, I mean, they probably got something in there about horse and carriages. It's way outdated.
It was way overdue.
Yeah, and it's the type of legislation that, you know, you can convince people to get around because it's so outdated. So you tell them, we want to modernize, we want to update. But they're not actually pushing the needle too much. I do appreciate it. I think it's one of those changes where you're glad it's happening, but you still want a lot more. And I think to Garen's point, while we look for this electoral consensus, the reality is in the United States, there is consensus around common sense gun reform. I think about 85% of people want these common sense changes. And so we have to really spend our time, and by our time, I mean all of 3 seconds, to figure out that a big part of this ties back into policing and our commitment to this form of violence as a form, as a means for controlling crime. The reality is that if we insist on maintaining the level of funding that we give to the carceral system, to jails, to prisons, to police, then we will always have powerful gun lobbies and powerful gun rights laws, because the reality is these two things are very connected.
And don't forget, the criminal code will not go into effect. It's not scheduled to go into effect until 2025, but it still is subject to congressional oversight. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. Mm-hmm. And then we can get into the whole conversation about statehood, and that's another show. But speaking of the federal level, we've got to talk about this DocuGate and Joe Biden and Donald Trump. You know, Jared, I think from politically, I think a lot of Democrats were supporters of Joe Biden when this came up. They were the news was head snapping as to why something like this is an issue. Tell us something we don't know about this.
So, you know, the document gate, as you call it, it certainly took the White House by surprise. I can tell you that the energy at the White House has shifted greatly. President Biden and the Biden administration, Biden-Harris administration, kind of was having a victory lap up until this point. You know, they were celebrating unemployment being low, even though we've been having issues with the economy, with inflation. You know, the numbers were, the inflation has started to cool. President Biden has signed so many historic pieces of legislation into law, from funding for infrastructure and the Inflation Reduction Act, which is going to, you know, reduce costs for people, for their health costs and their energy costs. But then all of a sudden, we find out that President Biden had, when he was vice president, he had documents from the Obama administration in his possession. And at first it started out as a tale of, oh, just 10 documents in his office in the Penn Biden Center in Washington, D.C. President Biden said that he was surprised and he didn't know that they were in his possession. And then we find out that not only were there more documents, but they had been discovered even when the White House was telling us that they had been cooperating with the DOJ, and that they were only referring to the first 10, and we found out that there were more. And then we ended up finding out that there were documents found in November and December and in January. And so we don't know what is in the content of these classified documents. You know, there are three different types of classified documents. There's, you know, top secret, secret, and there's classified. And so we don't know to what degree this is a threat to national security. And the reason why this is such a big deal is I think some voters and some Americans might not really care about these documents. They're like, why should I care about classified documents? And to some degree, you know, one might not care, but it matters because it would, if this was in the possession of a bad actor, and if the information in these classified documents were in their hands, and depending on what this information is, it could jeopardize the security of America. And it also comes at a time when, you know, former President Trump had a similar but very different issue with having classified documents in his possession. He had over 300 classified documents and resisted every step of the way when the National Archives and the DOJ tried to get them back from him. He believed that he had the right to have them in his possession. And so the Biden administration has been repeatedly making the argument that how they handled this once these classified documents were discovered, that they did the right thing, that they immediately, his personal lawyers immediately contacted the National Archives and the DOJ and have been cooperating with them, that they did these searches and they immediately turned these documents over. But it's becoming a political cloud over his head, and it could potentially be a legal issue for the president. We just don't know yet because right now there's a special counsel investigating this, Robert Hur, and, you know, he will do this investigation. This could take months or potentially longer. He will then refer that information back to Attorney General Merrick Garland, who will decide whether or not this is a case in which there needs to be charges involved. President Biden could be subpoenaed to speak to the special counsel about whether or not he really did know that these things were in his possession. I think it's also worth noting that the second and third batch of classified documents were in his personal residence in Delaware. And so it's created a huge headache for this administration. They're very reluctant to answer our questions about these documents. Every time this is asked, and it's been in every briefing they've been asked about this, they repeatedly say, no, we refer your questions to the DOJ, and we just will not comment until this investigation is over. But journalists and I'm sure some voters and some Americans want to know why it is that we found out about these documents after it was leaked to the media, and why the administration did not immediately inform the public about this, because the first batch were found just days before the election.
Yeah, the midterm election. Yeah.
And as we know, Hillary Clinton, she blamed FBI Director James Comey for his infamous press conference in which he announced that they had found more emails that had classified information, and she believed that that cost her the 2016 presidential election. And here we are yet again, where we're heading into the 2024 presidential election, and the two leading candidates, presumably for that election, President Joe Biden and former President Trump, are now engulfed in issues of having classified documents in their possession. So it's certainly a serious issue. We just don't know how serious yet.
Politically, Dr. Board, what do you think this does to, you know, President Biden? Certainly it's a mess, and I do agree with Jaron, because my question is, who does that? I mean, I'm serious. And before you answer, let me just say, the thing that bothers me personally, when I was in the U.S. Foreign Service, back in the late 80s, one of the, and I don't know what the procedure is now.
Sure.
But back in the late 80s, and we were dealing with classified, secret, and top secret documents. There was a procedure. Once you handled them, you got them from wherever they came from, you put them back.
Mm-hmm.
you did not, you didn't keep them. Your colleagues didn't keep them. Your deputy chief of mission didn't. No one kept the document. You got it. You looked at it. You put it back. Now, I know we're talking about presidents and in this case, vice presidents, right. But it just seems so messy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't love to talk about things this way, but the reality is this is the emperor and the emperor has no clothes. And it's just honestly that simple. I grew up in a military household and people with top secret clearance, and they have these conversations about what that clearance process is like and what their rules are and the regulations and all that stuff. And there's certain people who that rules on some level don't apply to. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think I will say, Garen, I do think that Comey's decision did affect Hillary Clinton's election, but we're past that. And I do think that them withholding it to the midterms, I'm like, you know, strategically, you probably do want to do that. But I do love the idea that this question of accountability, particularly for elites and specifically political elites, is one that I think the press and the media, of which we are participating in right now, has to continue to ask and push, because if it's not from here, then, you know, the folks that we're talking to on the call, they don't necessarily have the capacity to bring that question to the fore in people's minds. Politically, in terms of electorally, one of the big things that they're going to have to do is convince the question about all you know, Trumpism and the left and the right and the Democrats and Republicans. The big question comes down to, can you continue to build momentum and convince your side to turn out? That's truly the only thing they need. And so this thing will fall to the wayside. It will not be a big issue, but it will help the right be able to say, look at us. We were able to show that they were causing this problem much more than we were, and we were right and justified in not dealing with it appropriately.
Yeah, well, you could also argue that if it ends up being a Biden versus Trump in 2024, I can only see the debate where Biden says, well, what about you and those documents? And Trump says, what about you and those documents? Okay, next question.
Next question.
Next question. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Marcus Borden, Jared Keith Gaynor. Thank you for talking to us. I appreciate your time. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.